This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Monday, April 29th. Ontario is cracking down on cell phone use in schools to curb distractions. We'll ask Ontario's Minister of Education how teachers are supposed to enforce the new rules. Plus, 18 parliamentarians were the target of Chinese hackers in 2021, but the victims are only just learning of it. We'll speak to Liberal MP John McKay, who says he was targeted. And campus protests spreading across the United States have made their way north. The power panel on what's at stake politically as pro-Palestinian encampments grow on Canadian campuses. We begin today with those new rules in Ontario schools. Starting this fall, the government will ban vaping on school grounds, and parents of students caught breaking the rule will be notified. There will also be new restrictions on cell phone use. Students in kindergarten to grade 6 will be required to have their cell phones on silent and out of sight all day. But for grade 7 to grade 12 students, cell phone use is entirely banned during class unless otherwise allowed by teachers. The province will also ban social media platforms on school networks and devices.
Overwhelming, right? Like it's staggering numbers, the numbers I've seen with parents supporting the ban because they want their kids to go to school and learn, not to be on social media and fiddling around with their cell phones during class.
Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Good to be back, David.
Minister, I remember in 2019 you banned cell phones in schools. Now you're banning them again in 2024. Why is this ban different than the old ban?
Well, in 2019, the government of Ontario announced a requirement that school boards produce a plan to restrict cell phone use in schools. Some had strong plans and most did not. And here we're at the point where we have a patchwork without enforcement and with many school boards really asking the province, sort of saying, look, we don't have the solution. And I saw the data. I've seen the data on the distractions in schools, the impacts it's having on academic success and mental health. And I think all of us, everyone, any parent, any teacher will acknowledge there's a problem in our school system. And so we've learned lessons from 2019. We're not going to allow school boards to build policies, some of which could be strong, many of which were weak. We're going to set a high standard province-wide with enforcement, mandatory learning and curriculum, and new resources province-wide to support addictions and mental health. So there's a variety of lessons learned right. from other jurisdictions who have attempted to do this. And I have confidence that the plan is comprehensive and fundamentally it restores a sense of academic rigor and safety and common sense back within Ontario's school system.
Okay, so essentially last time you gave them the authority to come up with a plan to implement a ban. This time you're implementing the ban and you'll give them the ability to come up with exemptions as required, if necessary. For example, if a kid has a learning need or a medical need and they need a phone in school, they can have those exceptions there. That's how this will work.
So we created the exceptions list. We will impose that on school boards. We have really set out the policy with specificity at the provincial level, and we're requiring school boards to implement it. Essentially, a policy that was developed from the top, really developed from the bottom up when it comes to speaking to students and parents and educators and health experts, but it will be enforced from the top down. I really think that's important, that we have a provincial standard, a broad set of expectations, and an emphasis province-wide on the back to basics agenda. And I just think government needed to step up at this point. At how many more data points do we need as a society until governments have the courage to bring forth strong, robust, comprehensive, compassionate policies that change behavior and right. fundamentally, for the better, change the culture in schools?
Okay, I want to talk about the enforcement in just a sec, but you say you've seen the data points. What is the data? What is it you've looked at that makes the case? Because in the scientific community, there is not a consensus on this, that banning cell phones automatically leads to better academic outcomes. So what's the data you've seen that has convinced you, and will you make it all public?
Well, we're restricting cell phones. I mean, I just want to be clear in the language.
Right.
There's not an outright ban, because if you're right, that has not worked in most jurisdictions. We have restricted during instructional time. That's the policy. When you're sitting in a chair in front of a teacher, we're giving the authority and the teeth to the educator to use their judgment on when technology is a value add and when it is not. But with respect to the data, I mean, CAMH has a study that's been produced on the use of smartphones, that over a third of these kids are spending more than 5 hours a day on their smartphone. There's a study from UNESCO that came out just in 2023 that reaffirms the negative link between cell phone distractions and the ability of students to refocus. It takes usually up to 20 minutes just after looking and scrolling for 1 minute on social media. EQAO data. I mean, David, we still have in this province, and I'm sure it's the case in many jurisdictions in Canada, where more than half the kids are not meeting the provincial math standard. So I just believe objectively, based on academic data, let alone mental health data, that's coming out of CHEO and CAMH, and of course, the Hospital for Sick Children, the message is, I think, the government needs to bring forth a plan that refocuses schools and children on academics, that gives teachers authority. And I think a great lesson learned for me is that we have to back our teachers, back our principals, back our superintendents and school boards. And the message I'm sharing to parents, because just this afternoon, parents received a letter from the government, from myself, outlining those expectations. And I want families to know that we in the government have the teachers back. We will support them dispassionately implementing and enforcing this policy. And I want them to hear that, because I think in jurisdictions, I mean, Quebec and other jurisdictions, a lot of educators have told us, we didn't hear that message. And then principals didn't enforce the message. They didn't really have the, they feel like they didn't have the license to do that. So this is a different approach. We're going to start with prevention through curriculum, mandatory learning on responsible use of technology, right, online citizenship skills, and obviously the perils of vaping, cannabis, and tobacco. Ever since the federal government legalized cannabis, we've seen an explosion of data that suggests that Ontario and Canada have among the highest vaping and cannabis rates in the industrialized world. So we have a problem. We have a plan to deal with it. It's serious. But it starts with education. It really is about embracing the concept of prevention in opposed to enforcement. But yes, we do have to have teeth. We have to have deterrence. And we have to signal to parents and kids we are serious about changing the culture in schools.
Okay, I want to get into that. And just for people listening at home, CAMH is the Canadian Association for Mental Health, for people who don't know the acronyms, just so they can know who you're referencing there. But you say you'll get the teachers' backs, and you sent a public messaging on that. But you're not going to be in the classroom, right? And there have been concerns expressed by teachers and teachers' unions that they're going to have to seize cell phones and take cell phones away if people don't comply with the policy. And it puts them in a very difficult situation of doing that. And they're concerned about who is responsible for, say, a cell phone that is taken away from a student and something happens to it, or it goes missing and creates challenges that way. How do you deal with those concerns? Because, this is a blanket policy, as you say. So how do you deal with those concerns being raised?
Well, the first point of this policy is that it respects the professional judgment of educators. And I will respect the judgment of educators when technology is a value and when it is a hindrance to learning and academic achievement. So I will respect their decisions. And when the teacher comes in, the default in September is out of sight, out of mind, and kids are on their phone, they now know that the ministry has codified a progressive discipline policy and that asks them to, in good faith, try to change the behavior of the child. But if they're not able to follow the clear direction of the teacher, there can be progressive discipline steps in place. We're going to be training our educators. Another lesson learned from jurisdictions east and west of us is that they didn't do sufficient training on the classroom management techniques, how to create this change, how to create buy-in of students. And we're also going to be democratizing the progress of kids. I think parents should know from a transparency perspective. So we're going to ask teachers to include in the report card. We're going to standardize that across Ontario.
How do they assess that, though, Minister?
To measure.
How do you assess the level of distractibility? I noticed that. I've got a couple of kids in school. How am I going to know on the report card? I know A, B, C, D. How does it work in this sort of metric?
So some teachers today already do this. They literally will say, your child is very distracted in school, or your child is, incredibly attentive. So they usually include knowledge comments in the comment section, but it's not universal, and I would submit a minority of teachers are doing that today. I want to standardize that. So teachers use their own judgment about the capacity of the student to learn, to engage, to collaborate with their colleagues, to debate civilly and build those social-emotional communication skills. For me, this is really just from a broader, almost like an existential challenge for our society. We have young people who cannot communicate anymore. I feel like our school system in the West has lost its humanity. We aren't strengthening those imperatives of being able to communicate and share and collaborate and fundamentally think critically. And so this is a rethinking and a reimagination of education around core educational principles, back to basics, like reading, writing, and math. We will benchmark improvements. We're going to look at data like literacy and math. EQAO in Ontario, it's our standardized assessment system. We can literally assess academic improvement and mental health improvement. And that is the aim of this policy reform. For vaping, it's the same principle, but it's a much more absolute policy because it is illegal to vape if you're under 18 anyway. You shouldn't be owning cannabis. You shouldn't be owning tobacco or any of these things. And yet they've become safe spaces in schools. And to your point about the 2019 policy, you know, I'm sure was well-intended, but it didn't have the effect or the teeth. So this policy on vaping was actually born from student trustees. I said, asked a simple question, what would change your behavior? And they all said to me, if you called my parent. And so the first step in the policy is to call the parent, inform them of that their child is vaping on school property, remove the device, not return it. And of course, engage addiction services for those kids that may need it.
Well, that's where I wanted to go, Minister, because punishing a kid for vaping on campus. I mean, when I was growing up, people smoked, you know, by the basketball courts because there was no vaping.
Right.
So it's a similar sort of challenge, though the health risks of this and the addiction levels of this are also severe. So how do you deal with the addictions issue? I get it. You punish them if they're smoking in the bathroom, smoking on school grounds. But there is a shortage of capacity to handle addictions as it is right now. So how does this work in this plan?
Yeah. It's just important to recognize that this can't just be, we can't just bring a hammer. We're not going to change behavior. We're going to have to bring people along. So part of this is education on vaping. We already have mandatory learning on the perils of vaping cannabis in our physical health curriculum. We're going to be massively expanding it, bringing it to earlier ages for young kids to really understand the risks and the importance of personal responsibility and just understand what they're doing and what they are inhaling. With respect to the question, we've brought in a $30 million investment for vape detectors. That'll help to create greater transparency for the staff when vaping is being used. In one board in Northern Ontario that piloted these detectors, they saw a significant reduction in suspensions in graffiti and, perhaps most relevant, the reduction in vaping in their schools. Mm-hmm. So we want to model that across Ontario. And then with respect to the role of mental health supports, we get that. We totally understand the importance. It's why we've stepped up with an investment of an additional $15 million to leverage community-based healthcare for addiction services. You know, yesterday the announcement, CAMH, as you mentioned, a leading Canadian Center for Mental Health and Addictions, came out to endorse the program, particularly on vaping, because they recognize that we have high rates of utilization of vaping, and we don't have enough deterrence, and we aren't engaging parents and community sufficiently. So this is about connecting the dots and helping use community capacity to support our kids. Of course, we're increasing funding for mental health in schools too. But we're really looking at this through a compassion lens, because at the end of the day, through hearts and minds, we're trying to change behavior, change the daily routine of a child where they can live without the dependence on, for example, a vape. And many of these kids are using vaping for a variety of other reasons, dependence and coping mechanisms. And it's sad, I think, for all of us to see this happening. It's been normalized, and I think that should be a worry for our society and as a population.
Right.
That's why the government and the premier said, look, we got to do something about this. I mean, how many studies do we need? How many years of consultation? Like, get on with delivering change in schools. And
okay.
That's why we said when we were going to go back to basics, it really starts with this, with establishing focus back in schools.
Okay, Minister, we got to leave it there. And thank you for correcting me. It's the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, not the Canadian Association of Mental Health. I got my acronyms wrong. Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Some parliamentarians are upset that the federal government failed to warn them they were targets of hacking by China. The 18 MPs and senators are members of an international group called the Parliamentary Alliance on China. And the FBI allegedly warned that organization of the cyber attacks back in 2022, but members of the group were only informed by the alliance last week.
It seems that there is still a gap in terms of informing and protecting members of parliament in the exercise of their parliamentary duties, and this is a matter which should be taken up as soon as possible.
John McKay is a Liberal MP on that group, and he joins me now. Mr. McKay, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you, David.
We've been having a heck of a time getting to the bottom of this today, and it seems you are as well. I mean, what exactly do we know and not know about what China tried to do to you and your colleagues here?
A good question, to which I probably don't have a much better answer than do you. As I understand, the FBI informed relevant governments. Well, just to back up for a second, mm-hmm. This is a large international organization of parliamentarians interested in human rights pertaining to China. And so I belong to it along with 13 other colleagues. And the FBI was doing a surveillance. And that turned up a few email addresses and some suspicious activities. They in turn informed the relevant governments around the world. None of us knew anything, including the Central IPAC organization, and really only learned in March that when the indictment was unsealed,
mm-hmm.
that we had been targeted. So the IPAC people sat down with the FBI people and compared email lists. And it turns out that I and a number of other Canadian colleagues, along with quite a number of international colleagues, are on that list, and we've been subject to a fishing expedition, which I won't pretend to try to explain to you. I was rather hoping you'd explain it to me.
Well, as I understand it, because we had Catherine Tunney on the show earlier, and she covers national security for us, and like they send you an email with a photo in it, and in one of the pixels in the photo is embedded a piece of malware that fires off into the device you open the email on and tries to scrape as much information out as it can, I guess, to find out what it can, but also, I guess, search for vulnerabilities for a more aggressive and progressive attack the next time.
And it keeps on going.
And then it goes from there.
It keeps on going. And as it may still be going in my own emails. And what disturbs me is that not only is it information about me, but it's my constituents and anyone with whom I correspond. And I think it's perfectly legitimate for my constituents to assume that their emails are protected.
Do you know if you or because this there's so many blind spots in this story, even for you, Mr.
Yes. Mike,
and this is like, do you know if an email got through to you, that it was opened by you or your staff? Because I know there are email addresses that your staff would access, not just you. Do we even know that it worked or that you were exposed or hacked in any way?
I have no idea. And that's what's the disturbing part of it, is that I may have been compromised or I may still be compromised or there may be nothing.
So you got a lot to worry about or nothing to worry about,
well,
but you don't know what you should be worried about is the problem.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the FBI uncovered this. They're not allowed to contact you directly because there's rules, I guess, about Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Well, perfectly
contacting parliamentarians. Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah.
So you said the relevant governments, because this organization you're a part of, it's a whole host of nations who would be familiar allies in a lot of cases. They were told. Who in government? Was this CSIS? Was it the Communications Security Establishment? Was it Public Safety? Was it the Prime Minister's Office? This is even unclear to me at this stage of who in the Canadian government apparatus was
It's still
was
unclear to me. I have approached the Minister of Public Safety to clarify that point, I'm anticipating that he'll respond in a timely fashion. But it is a whole alphabet soup of various organizations that are supposed to be protecting the security and communications of not only MPs and government officials, but also Canadians writ large.
I saw footage today, I believe it was after question period, when we got one of those rare high shots of the House of Commons, and you walked over to Dominic LeBlanc's desk, the Minister of Public Safety, on the floor of the House of Commons. I'm assuming to speak about this. Did you get any sense of when you might know more or how you might know more in your chat with Mr. LeBlanc?
We had a conversation in the lobby afterwards, yes.
Okay. And no further insight on timeline or the extent of what may have actually happened at this point still? It just seems that way?
Nothing that I can share at this point. I'm rather hoping that I'll have answers sooner rather than later.
This has been one of the things we've seen throughout the whole foreign interference controversy in this country, and that's coming up at the inquiry, is the inability to get plain answers on things. I understand the need to protect national security and privacy laws, but you look at the Americans, you look at the Brits, they'll lay it out and say, someone on this date tried this, here's what they targeted, and here you go. Here's the actions we took and the actions MPs and parliamentarians need to take. We don't get anything close to that in this country, not just the media, but even the parliamentarians themselves. I mean, what needs to change on that?
Well, in some respects, it's the nature of the beast. On the other hand, we seem to have a lot more secrets than anybody else has. Because I chair the Defense Committee and involve myself in military matters, I have some briefings that would be classified briefings.
Right.
I have to say that there are times where I wonder why this particular information is classified. It seems to me that we need a bit of a culture change here.
Mm-hmm.
We particularly need a culture change in the change threat environment. This is, well, really since the Ukrainian war, this is a very changed threat environment, and people need to be informed, and they need to be informed much more than they currently are. And if you're informed, like me, then you can at least react to the nature of the threat and take, hopefully, preventative action. But we do seem to have a culture of secrecy, which is somewhat distressing.
I'm not defending the lack of notification here, but is it maybe good news that no news could be good news, that had you been fundamentally compromised by this, you would have been told, and maybe because it didn't work or didn't succeed, that's why the lack of notification?
That's a theoretical possibility.
Yeah. No, I mean, you should know, right? No, so you can protect yourself, because you have to do your job now without knowing, right? So what do you do now, not knowing that the level of penetration into your private records and emails or computer systems or phones? I mean, what steps do you take? And has anyone given you any advice since this came to light?
So far, it's crickets.
It's wild.
I do intend, after my conversation with the minister, to phone up the people that monitor our emails and the whole system, and ask them, should I be worried, or what should I be worried about? Because at this point, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I have, 150, 200 emails a day. Two offices and, six people looking at the material, and any one of them could have clicked on anything, and suddenly we've compromised the entire system. We would have no idea.
So right now, we know who was targeted. We don't know if anyone was compromised. We know someone in Canada was informed, but we don't know who, and we don't know what steps they took, and we don't know why you were informed or not informed, and if this met the threshold for notification. But other than that, it's perfectly clear.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? All right.
Okay, I think you've got it.
All right. So Garnet Jennis, just as a final point, he rose in Parliament today, say this is a breach of privilege, that something like this happened. We saw similar things with Michael Chong and Jenny Kwan, when they were individually targeted or family members targeted, and they felt their privileges as an MP were breached. Do you share his concern that this might constitute a breach of privilege?
I would have supported Mr. Jennis at 11 o'clock, except I chair of the Defense Committee, and so I could just simply physically couldn't be there. But I think the points he was making are perfectly valid, and I'm rather hoping that the Speaker comes back with a ruling. I may or may not rise myself and speak to the issue. We'll have to see what the next 24 hours reveals.
John McKay, if you get any answers, we'd love for you to come back and share them. We appreciate you taking the time.
Well, David, if I ever get any answers, you'll be the second to know.
All right. Liberal MP John McKay, thanks for your time, sir.
Thanks again.
A pretty tense and heated tone today in the House of Commons as the Liberals seized on Pierre Poilievre's controversial stop at a protest camp last week, calling on the Conservative leader to denounce white supremacist and misogynistic groups. Poilievre had a rebuttal, and here's how that unfolded in question period.
Last week, we saw the leader of the opposition once again visit with supporters of white supremacy, anarchy, and misogyny. This has been a regular occurrence. I ask him to clearly disavow the views of these dangerous people. Will he do that?
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
I unequivocally disavow the guy who spent the first half of his adult life as a practicing racist dressing up in blackface.
Okay, it was that kind of day in the House of Commons. We're going to talk about this and a bunch of the other issues that were discussed today with the Power Panel. Lisa Raitt is a former Conservative cabinet minister. Brad Levine is a former communications director for the NDP. And here with me in the studio, Vandana Cotter is a former advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And Rob Russo is a former CBC parliamentary bureau chief. Rob, I'll start with you. The question Pierre Poilievre asked was about the decriminalization decision unfolding in British Columbia. The response from the government House leader was clearly scripted and planned to raise this issue, and you saw how he replied. What do we make of what we saw happen today?
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure it was particularly edifying from both sides. Look, he has already condemned this group. I think he's called them odious losers. This is the Diagonalon people, has he not? For suggesting that they might be interested in assaulting his wife. Mm-hmm. Has he played footsie with people who wanted to shut down the street in front of the Supreme Court of Canada and shut down Parliament? Yes, he has done that. But to suggest that he's in favor of white supremacists and the people who wanted to assault his wife, I think might be a bridge too far. I've always said politics is about addition and not subtraction. I'm not sure where the addition is for Mr. Poilievre in meeting with the groups that he met with in New Brunswick, apart from those who might be part of Diagonalon. maybe he's done the calculus and he's decided that those who are interested in a tax revolt might be better for him. But I'm not sure that this is a winning strategy for the Liberals, and I'm not sure that his response was necessarily edifying either.
Brad, what did you make of this as a moment in Parliament? I mean, this is clearly an issue the Liberals want to raise, as you can tell from their social media feeds. And you saw that response there from Mr. Polyev, that if they're going to come at him with this, he's going to come right back with that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, just think, David, we only have another 12 or 18 months of this tone in Parliament. It's going to be a long, you know, the phony war leading up to the next federal election. There's no question about it. You know, did Polyev make a mistake by stopping and meeting with this group? I think he certainly handed his opponents something to club him with. In the absence of that, who knows what the Liberals would have had today to go out on against Polyev. And of course, you know, Trudeau's given the gift that keeps on giving, which is the blackface, and then of course messing up the response to where he can't remember how many times he dressed up in blackface. So the question is there any new room for undecideds to be convinced one way or another? I think these are both well worn. I think blackface has run its course. I don't know if too many folks who are leaning Liberal now all of a sudden now hear blackface and will retreat on that. But you know, the challenge that that Polyev has as a front runner, as a lead in the polls, and not just the stop in Atlantic Canada with this group, but also with the Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist out of the States, you know, pretty much coming out and endorsing Pierre Polyev. You know, how close can he get to that radical fringe without losing the mainstream that you need in order to win a majority in the House of Commons? And of course, you know, to Rob's point, how many people do you attract by stopping versus just keep going and not offering your opponents any opportunity to come back and punch you in the nose next time the House hits?
You know, Lisa, there's obviously we get accused of hand-wringing too much of a tone on these shows when you talk about how things are going in the House of Commons. But this was clearly something the Liberals had teed up ready to go today. And just tactically, I feel like you should have anticipated that was going to come back, because Mr. Polyev has that line of defense in the past before. I just wonder, where do you think this is going? I mean, there's a pretty heated argument going on there about the decriminalization issue with drugs in British Columbia, and this is where the conversation goes in the Parliament.
Issues are important. I find this terribly boring that we're discussing this yet again, quite frankly. For reality check, people aren't paying attention when this stuff happens at all. And even if they are, people who like Trudeau or Polyev are going to still like them, and people who don't like Trudeau or Polyev are still going to not like them. This doesn't move the needle. All it does, I think, is to make them both look like that they'd rather sling mud than they would work on the issues of Canadians. I don't think it helps.
Vandana, how do you see it?
Maybe people aren't paying attention to the House of Commons, but now there's a beautiful little media clip that the Liberals can use to push out. And they can just push that out and that clip that piece saying that Pierre Polyev has refused to denounce this group. And I think what it does is sets up the Liberals to say that, what kind of prime minister do you want? And kind of creep that contrast to the PM and show that he's not ready. So what the prime minister did, he did something a long time ago when he was much younger, where he didn't understand the repercussions of what he was doing, right? He doesn't understand what the hurt that would create, and he's apologized for that. Pierre Polyev met with someone, a far-right group, last week, and knows the repercussions of that and how hurt people would be from that, and still refuses to apologize for it, and instead deflects an answer and just points to something that happened a long time ago that the PM has already responded to. And I think what it says, if you want the big job and you want to represent Canadians across the country, then actions speak louder than words, and you should be able to denounce white supremacy, full stop. That should be very easy. And then if he said that, that cuts that argument. But instead, now the Liberals can use this over and over again on a clip, on an ad, on social media, and say, Pierre Polyev refused to denounce it. And maybe it doesn't convince everybody, but starts picking at this sense that maybe you don't want this guy to be the next guy.
Okay, Lisa, I want to move out this, and I want to talk about one of the other issues that was talked about there, but I did want to get everybody's round of that because of what we saw there today. The issue of foreign workers at these auto deals, as part of the auto deals that we're seeing. The Conservatives want the government to make contracts with companies like Stellantis, Volkswagen. They want them public after a union said foreign workers could fill positions that could go to Canadians. Here's how the Prime Minister responded to this today.
We need to make sure there are as many Canadian workers as possible, if not almost all Canadian workers doing the construction and maintenance and installation. I will highlight, though, that it is something that the Conservatives seem to have latched onto to try and distract from the fact that they actually don't support the Stellantis investment.
Okay, the Prime Minister, Lisa, obviously they're making a very political argument, but on the math, here's the question I have, because he's at the CBTU, the Canada Building Trades Union meeting, and they have been the union raising the alarm about what's happening with the Stellantis plant. There are 2,000 people working on that project. 72 of those jobs are foreign workers. 1,600 of those jobs are members of that union. Is this a big deal that a small number of foreign workers on a workforce that large are there when the company says they need them for specific time-limited tasks? What's your view of it?
It could be. I mean, it depends on whether or not that's going to be a number that grows. You know, when the United States were putting in place the way that they were going to be coming out of the Great Recession, one of the things that they did do with respect to labor was they made it very, very clear that the United States labor was going to be essential. In fact, they do that a lot. They make sure that they take care of their own. And there's nothing to say that the Prime Minister couldn't have done exactly the same thing in these kinds of contracts, and he didn't. And I think that may be a better way of approaching it than the numbers game. But, you know, it is very effective and impactful for people to say, well, these jobs are just going to go to people who are coming over to build instead. And it does seem to be a meme that is out there and that is believed. Your numbers are interesting, David. I haven't heard it put that way before. Obviously, 72 isn't a big number, but it seems like it's a bigger issue than what it is, I suppose.
Yeah, Rob, it's less than 4% of the workforce there, and 1,600 of them are in the union. That is the most upset about this. I was speaking with some people in the union movement today, and they feel this is maybe overblown. I don't know. I mean, I've seen in the oil industry back home that people came in to get it going and then went away once it was going, and locals filled the jobs. That's the argument here.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the cross-partisan nature of support for this investment with Conservatives in Ontario and Liberals in Ottawa supporting this, it kind of mutes the argument. I also find that the criticism of the deals by Conservatives have been muted. They're going after this, but they haven't gone after very loudly the investment. I think the most effective argument against the investment has come from a Liberal. It's come from Mark Carney, who believes that the money might have been best invested on a less risky investment that has an impact on Canadians right in their own homes. Get heat pumps for people where they can work. You do that, you're going to spend a lot less than $40 or $50 billion. You're going to bring home climate change, the benefits of preparing for climate change to them. I thought that was a more effective criticism than the criticism of whether or not we should bring in a couple of people to show us how to use the machinery that we don't know how to use. I'm thinking about buying a chainsaw. If somebody wants to come along from Home Hardware and show me how to use a chainsaw so I don't remove my kneecaps, I'm going to be in favor of that.
Yeah, okay. Just to pick up on what you said about Mr. Carney, and look, he knows way more about money than I will ever know about money. And I appreciate his argument that, you know, the retail politics of giving people heat pumps for the buy-in. But future-proofing your most important manufacturing industry has a value to the country, does it not? I mean, you know, otherwise a lot of money is going to go to a lot of other places that aren't Ontario.
You're making a very large bet on something that might happen 10 years from now. It's a speculative bet. I think that's where, just based on what I've seen, I think we're going to a net zero auto industry over the next 25 years. But is it going to be this technology? We don't know. Is the IRA still going to be there in a year? We don't know. And if you don't have the IRA, are you going to have to fork over these
no, subsidies? It's in the contract. That's if the IRA goes away, the subsidies.
So then,
go
what happens? What happens to the corporate side of that equation? Are they going to stick with this as well if that goes away? Lots of unanswered questions. It's a big, huge bet. Maybe they win big, but they won't be around, I don't think, when the bet comes in one way or another.
Brad, on the foreign workers angle, I know Jagmeet Singh says he's concerned about this and says he wants to make sure there's good union-paying jobs. Honda isn't unionized, so I'm not sure how it fits into necessarily that particular arrangement. But do you think there's a political vulnerability here, or is this, you know, a union playing to some of its memberships on this?
Well, I think it might have to do a little bit with communication as well, and also how the parent company who's undertaking the initiative, how they deal with workers. You've got, you know, large majority of workers in the Stellantis LG plant are Canadian. We're talking about building the facility itself. So those are different people than the ones that will actually produce the products, whether it's assembly or the cars themselves. Now, you take a look at what Honda's doing. Honda's actually sitting down with the Canadian building trades unions and seeking to come up with a memorandum of understanding as to who's going to build what, who's going to be trained on what, and bringing in that expertise. And you can see the officials from Honda talking about how once we talk about labor shortages, once we talk about training, that they'll satisfy some of these criticisms that the union is flagging. And it's early stages in the Honda initiative versus the Stellantis one, which is a kind of LG, you know, is obviously overseas, but Stellantis is Chrysler North American. So I think it actually has to do with that. I think if you sit down with the unions and you talk about what's going to be happening, who's coming in, you break down some of those communication challenges. I'm not saying it's all communication problems, but I'd much rather have the union sitting down with Honda, even though Honda's assembly is non-unionized, but the building of the facility.
Right.
Will be. These are the people, the electricians, the iron workers, Layuna, all of these folks who are going to be building the plants themselves. Much better way of going about it, in my opinion. So I think that there might be some broken telephone, and it also might have to do with how the parent employer deals with workers in general.
Yeah, but Brad, just on that, I mean, I come back to the math. You know, if someone came in and said, we're going to create 2,000 construction jobs, and 96.4% of them will be Canadian unionized jobs, and we need 3%, 3.5% of the workforce to come in to deal with technical specifications that we need for this phase of the project. Yeah. Is this a drag them in front of the parliamentary committee level of issue? Help me understand this.
Yeah, well, the claim by the Canadian building trades unions on the Stellantis LG plant is that there are, they're making the claim that in the Kent Middlesex area outside of Windsor, that there are qualified individuals who can do some of the jobs that the folks who have been brought in overseas can do. Now, they have to make that case, even if it's 50 or 25, whatever, that's the case that they're making. But that's why I'm thinking, as a percentage, it doesn't seem, 96 to 4 doesn't seem too lopsided. But the union's making the case here, the Alliance of Unions is making the case here that there's qualified individuals in the region who can do the job. So they got to press that case and make it. But no, 96 to 4 is not a bad ratio. The question is also, and this is what happens on some infrastructure projects, whether it's like the Canada Line SkyTrain in Vancouver for the 2010 Olympics, when you bring in expertise and then they have to make sure that they're training folks locally so that they can then carry on the work after it's done, versus coming in, right, leaving, and then we realize none of that benefit, and then the foreign workers go back home. So I think the CBTUs has to press its case with the Windsor area plants that they do have the talent here in order to build these facilities.
Vandana, where do you see this? The Prime Minister met with them today to try to reassure them, as did the Labour Minister. Randy Boissonneau is there as well. I mean, what do you make of it all?
I think this was an attempt at a political hit by the opposition. I think that's simply that. Like, when I read Rick Perkins, I think the statement, you know, I took a while to be like, what happened? What is this? But it really was just like an attempt to poke holes at something. I think what happened is that the government had to win that day. You know, they have a big project that's going to produce long-term sustainable jobs, that is going to reinvest in the auto industry and invigorate them. And I think it's not only just for the federal Liberal government, but for the provincial Conservative government. And I think Doug Ford thinks it's good for Canada and for growth. And I think what the opposition is trying to do is try to pick something that will be easy for the broader public to pick up. So you can just see on social media in a 30-second clip or something that we're protecting you from foreign workers. Now, personally, I hate the term foreign worker. I know that's the term, but I hate it. But it just adds a lot of other connotations there. But I think that was their attempt. And I think they're trying to find a way to, I think the government's trying to find their stride here. Mm-hmm. You see, they had a strong, you know, opening before the budget. You know, they had this great jobs announcement. So where can they poke holes in something good? They're not going to say we don't like the auto sector. They're not going to say we don't believe in, you know, EVs, but they're going to say, oh, but this won't help Canadian jobs, and give that inference so that the average person who doesn't have time to really look at the math and pay attention to be like, oh, did you not hear the government's filling this with foreign workers without understanding fully that that's actually not what's happening?
So Lisa, I mean, on this, once these things are up and running, I mean, it's going to be Canadians in the area working in the plants. I mean, those jobs, presumably the manufacturing jobs for the long term, will be Canadians. So, I mean, I just wonder, how concerned should people be about this? If it is such a small percentage and the permanent manufacturing jobs will be undoubtedly Canadian because of the locations of the plants, how big of a concern should this be for people?
I mean, I think the bigger concern for people should be whether or not these things actually do get built, quite frankly, because we're not at the final decision on investment. There's a lot of stuff that has to happen between now and then. And we're kind of looking at it like way in the future, what's possibly going to happen. I don't disagree with Vandana that this is something that the opposition does want to pick at. They want to create this kind of a belief that the government once again has screwed up on a deal and it's not good for Canadians. But it's playing into a feeling that a lot of people already have about this government. So that's why it's successful and that's why it's annoying, because people do not give this government the benefit of the doubt when it comes to negotiating economic contracts. And as a result, they're constantly having to show their work. And some of the stuff that they're doing, I'm going to say, it's good. It's really good. It's going to help long-term growth. But the reality is that they have to recognize that they're not going to be taken at their word anymore, that this is a good thing, and they got to be prepared to handle all the stakeholders wherever they're coming from.
Okay, we want to touch on another issue before we wrap it up, because pro-Palestinian protests ramped up at McGill University in Montreal over the weekend, with students setting up encampments on campus. Today, demonstrators at UBC in Vancouver are doing the same, demanding their schools divest from Israel-related investments. Liberal MPs weighed in on the encampments today.
McGill is a place of free discourse. It's one where the right to protest has to be respected. It doesn't, at the same time, that right allow violence.
Peaceful protest, I think, is everyone's right, and at the same time, it's important that everyone feels safe on the campuses.
It has nothing to do with whether a peaceful demonstration is allowed or not. An encampment is not allowed. I called on McGill to work with the Montreal police to do something about it because it's a violation of McGill policy.
Okay, Vandana, that's kind of a summary of the liberal conversation for the last couple of months on this. But look, we've seen what this has done in the United States at the campuses down there. I know these are provincial institutions and it's a local policing challenge, but people are going to look to the federal government to say something on this and do something on this. Where do you think this potentially goes now that we're seeing these encampments in Canada?
I think you've seen the maximum where it's going to go. I think you're going to see that people are going to say that, listen, you have a right to peacefully protest. You can share your legitimate view on the war, but if that crosses into hate speech, if it crosses into anti-Semitism, or people are feeling afraid for legitimate reasons, or they're being targeted, then yeah, that's going to cross a line, and McGill has to do something about that and has to denounce it. So I don't think they're going to go any further on this. I think they're going to keep it to where that is and then see what happens, and hopefully this stays like a peaceful protest where there isn't hate speech and that people don't get hurt.
You know, Rob, there's a lot of Jewish students concerned about this, nervous about this. We're hearing that a lawyer is going to take this to court tomorrow to try to get an injunction. We're going to speak with one of the organizers coming up in a little bit on the show. What are your thoughts as you see those sorts of images popping up at McGill?
Well, a lot of people are comparing these protests to what happened in 1968 when the protests against the Vietnam War started. Then, like now, it's a legitimate thing. And in many ways, it's an important thing for students who are learning about democracy to learn that protest is a legitimate and sometimes necessary part of functioning in a democracy. But in 1968, the students who were protesting against the war in Vietnam, rarely did I hear them say, we need to eliminate the United States, which is the aggressor in this war. And there are a lot of protesters who are involved in this who are saying, in effect, we need to eliminate the state of Israel in order to solve the Palestinian problem. Or they're saying, we support what happened on October 7th. It was a legitimate part of the struggle against the state of Israel. And that's where they cross into potentially hate speech.
Now, you're speaking about the American protests, right? Because I don't think we've seen anything connected to the McGill one yet.
McGill has said that it has evidence of people advocating violence, we haven't seen that evidence yet. Right. And there has been a shift in McGill's stance. This morning they said that they were going to ask police to remove those encampments, and this afternoon they decided not to. I think that the decision not to is a wise thing. People should be allowed to protest. Should they be allowed to go further and call for the elimination of an entire people from the map? No, I don't think that they should be. And I think that's what everybody is going to be watching to see where that part of the protest goes.
Brad, you know, you've led many student protests back in the day yourself on far less controversial issues like tuition fees. I mean, where do you see this going when you look at this and what we saw in the United States and you know, what we've seen in the streets of Canada since October?
Well, what I was fascinated about is how quickly across the United States this spread. And you saw the reports out of McGill today that just over the last, just over the weekend, it's only Monday, but, you know, the encampment there tripled in size. So, you know, it is likely that we'll be here next Monday talking on this panel about, you know, how many more campuses. Right now, I think there's a couple at least have been reported on. There may be more. There certainly will be more by next Monday. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it is completely legitimate for a student population to call on the institution to take certain actions, i.e. to divest. We certainly did that during the apartheid. And I'm certainly not comparing what happened in South Africa in the 1980s to what's happening in the Middle East. I'll leave that for the discussion. But nonetheless, it was legitimate for students of our generation to call on the institutions to take certain actions. I think where, there may be some support there. I think where the potential for losing support for the cause is when it goes beyond that. And to, you know, to the other panelists' point, where we call for the elimination of Israel, or we tolerate hatred towards Jews, or to make students feel uncomfortable because of their religion. And I know that that's certainly happening in the States. I know at Columbia, students who are from the Jewish community are being told to stay at home. And I don't know if that, in the long term, builds support for your cause or erodes it. And it's certainly, you know, listening to American news this morning during the morning workout, it's at a fever pitch. And I don't know the benefit of a fever pitch where neither sides are listening to each other at all. I don't know how we get that further. I think the only thing that's going to de-escalate it here in Canada, and particularly in the States, is to see movement on the conversations that you had in your early reports, David, about looking for an end to the hostilities in Gaza.
Yeah, Hamas has reportedly left Cairo to come back with a written counterproposal to the Israeli proposal. So who knows where that's going to go. But Lisa, when you see the sort of the campus protest movement coming north, not surprising, I guess, that it's here. But what are your thoughts on where this could potentially go and how McGill has responded to it so far?
Yeah, well, let's be really clear. You keep saying that it's student protest. My understanding from reports from McGill is that they have proof that it is not all students, that the increase has actually been people coming from off campus who are coming under the student movement, which for all the good reasons we've discussed already is a right for the ability to protest. But in the B-roll you just showed, David, I saw a sign in there that said something along the lines is resist until free. Well, what does resist harken back to? I think all I'm hearing about on resistance is that October 7 was a form of resistance and it was actually justifiable. So you can't tell me that sign, resist until free or resistance is essential. That to me is sending a very clear signal what we're talking about. That stuff cannot be tolerated. It is outright anti-Semitism and it has to be dealt with in the appropriate way. And I know that we're all worried about stepping on toes and you know, hand-wringing on this kind of stuff. But the reality is that we have to protect people in society. And that stuff is just not acceptable.
Yeah, Vandana, Lisa has a point that I don't know if McGill is saying they're not all students or not all McGill students. Certainly there's some Concordia students in there and probably, as Lisa said, people from the broader community coming in. But the signs and some of the language we've seen, I mean, resistance means many things to different people. People saying October 7th was resistance upsets people who point to nonviolent resistance, which speaks to sort of how fraught this whole thing has become, right?
Yeah, and I think that's where you're going to see a lot of, like, within the MPs and McGill looking for outright hate speech. And I think they're not going to look for interpretations of things. I think they're going to look for outright hate speech and actions that lead to anti-Semitism or make students feel discomfort. I think they know that McGill has a responsibility to not further make people feel polarized and drive this issue further. Mm. But I think if students are peacefully protesting and just legitimately sharing their views on the conflict, that's fine. But just keeping an eye out again on what's actually happening. And I think they're going to look for an actual, like, what is actually happening on hate speech? When is there actions on anti-Semitism? And wait for that to actually take an action.
Lisa, how do you, because you brought up that particular sign, how do you think they need to manage this particular issue at a situation like McGill, where so far it seems to just be an encampment, right? It doesn't, has risen to like high levels of aggression from the reporting that I've seen out of there. How do you manage it?
Well, I empathize with people who are trying to manage the situation on a day-to-day basis. There's no question about it. But I would say that it should be made extremely clear that the codes of conduct are being reviewed and that students will be held to the code of conduct. That's the case. And anybody who's not a student is trespassing, quite frankly.
So, Rob, we've heard there's going to be an injunction sought tomorrow. I don't know if they will obey an injunction. I don't know, because police would ultimately, I guess, have to enforce an injunction. And maybe this is a way the police action is taken without McGill having to be responsible for it. I'm not clear how this gets resolved. What's your sense?
We don't know. Mm. And we hope it's done peacefully. And we hope that those who are miscreants are prosecuted. If that means you go after people individually, that's fine. You know, I've said in the past here that I thought that the Prime Minister needed to show more leadership. I thought in the last week he did. I thought that he made a very clear statement in the last week in which he said glorifying the October 7th attacks represents an act of anti-Semitism. I think that that's a very clear standard that should be applied to these demonstrations across the country. If McGill, as they say, has video evidence of that kind of activity, they should hand it over to the police and the police should do their jobs.
Does the Prime Minister need to give a big speech on this? Like, I truly don't know. Rob Jussieu first and then Vandita, like, because clear message on it, but his own caucus is so conflicted with this. The big cities are conflicted with this. What could he do here?
I've said for a long, long time that we need to be brought together as a people. And that clear lines need to be spelled out from the Prime Minister. I think that that would be a valuable thing. Yes, it's a dangerous thing, but it's a valuable thing for people at a time when there is growing division. I think we need to hear from our leader.
Vandana, what do you think? I mean, it's a tough one.
I think the time for that has passed.
Yeah.
I think what he needs to do to bring people together is when these things come together, to try to bring in the fact that, you know, what brings us together? You know, what do we advance together as Canadians, right? And that is the right to protect one another, to feel protected, and how we live and who we are. But I think the best way to connect with people is actually small groups. And I think in his travels, he's meeting with small groups behind closed doors and really understanding the fears, the real fears, and bringing people together. And I understand some of that has been interfaith as well. So I think that is the best way, because the problem is the minute he takes a podium and starts talking about it, everyone's going to parse it differently.
Yeah.
As you know, this is a conflict that really hits people right here. You know, it's fraught in like intergenerational trauma and sensitivities, and people have a right to feel very strongly about this. So why add, with all due respect, a media component to it where people can take it and they can clip it and they can deepfake it, et cetera, et cetera? That's not going to help. That's going to further polarize other people. So I think what he's doing right now with meeting with small groups and keeping it behind closed doors and really listening, engaging, and sharing with people that this is... Now, that I know doesn't affect everyone, but we'll have to see. We'll see where the conflict goes. And there might come another instance where he should address the public and address. And I think there was a time where I felt like he strongly should. But I don't think that is now this time. I think now we have to see where things go. And, you know, hopefully this conflict comes to an end very soon. And in the peaceful process, I think that's an opportunity where he can address this again.
course, Honda isn't unionized, so I'm not sure how it fits into necessarily that particular arrangement. But do you think there's a political vulnerability here, or is this, you know, a union playing to some of its memberships on this?
Well, I think it might have to do a little bit with communication as well, and also how the parent company who's undertaking the initiative, how they deal with workers. You've got, you know, large majority of workers in the Stellantis LG plant are Canadian. We're talking about building the facility itself. So those are different people than the ones that will actually produce the products, whether it's assembly or the cars themselves. Now, you take a look at what Honda's doing. Honda's actually sitting down with the Canadian building trades unions and seeking to come up with a memorandum of understanding as to who's going to build what, who's going to be trained on what, and bringing in that expertise. And you can see the officials from Honda talking about how once we talk about labor shortages, once we talk about training, that they'll satisfy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.